lesson on science and technology, and I guess we'll have one more. We could have two more, but it looks like we're going to start our normal classes back a week from Wednesday, and I'm teaching, and so I was thinking I might cover art, culture, and human expression, because in some ways it's the complement of science and technology. If you think about what people study in college, right, Ryan? I mean, you know, you either study science or you study liberal arts, and so we might as well cover both ends of the spectrum, I guess, if you want to think about it that way. But that's what we'll do. And what I'd like to do is I'm just going to start with so I heard this on the radio Saturday. I was actually driving home, and it was a story about loneliness, which had originally aired in 2017. And the news bureau, you know, brought it back up because it seemed relevant because everybody's isolating at home and everything. But I just want to read the story to you. I hope you can see it. And just get your comments about it, really from the standpoint of how would a Christian view this story, especially as it relates to, you know, science. And the kind of, 'cause it's a scientific story, at least on some level. And it's actually an interview with the 19th U.S. Surgeon General, a guy named Dr. Vivek Murthy. He's not the Surgeon General now, but he was for a while. And anyway, here's what he said. He was describing why it is that loneliness is really, to some extent, one of those so-called underlying conditions, and it harms us. Over time, loneliness can deteriorate, make our health deteriorate. So this is his reasoning. As human beings, we evolved to be social creatures, and there was a very practical reason for that, because in ancient times, if we had other people that we were able to connect, that we were connected to, we had a stronger guarantee of stable food supply. We also had a greater chance of being protected from predators at night. We could all take turns keeping watch around the fire instead of having one person stay up the entire night. And over hundreds and thousands of years, that need for social connection became baked into our nervous system. And so if we are in a lonely state, it actually places us in a state of stress. And chronic stress is associated with increases in cortisol, increases the inflammation in the body, which can damage tissues and ultimately increase our risk of heart disease, obesity, and a number of other illnesses. Okay? I'm going to unmute all, and so just think about it a little bit. I would just more or less unstructured reactions are fine. We'll spend a couple of minutes. You got just a quick reaction. How does this strike you? All right.
It feels impossible to even think about or like feel like there's like a way to discuss it rationally, because it feels like you're grasping at straws for how that's even, what foundation that's even based on. I don't know. It makes it hard to even know where to start a discussion.
Yeah.
Sounds like a wolf pack.
Marty, can you hear me?
I can, Teresa.
Well, I did like the part where he talked about we had a strong guarantee of being the stable food supply. So he did show that if you stuck with a group, at least there was safety in numbers. So I did like that part, being protected from the predators and stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Erin, you're about to say something. I know.
Well, if we evolved to be social creatures, why are we not now evolving to change to help it? I just, when I say we evolve, then why aren't we changing to help the problems that are existing now?
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So we seems like we should evolve to deal with loneliness, since we're all lonely, right? But
yeah.
Fortunately, it takes hundreds of thousands of years, and we can't quite wait that long.
So that
we have Zoom.
Yeah, that's right. We've evolved to use Zoom. Yeah, Ryan?
Well, that to me is from a scientific standpoint, the issue, because good science is observation of what happens during experimentation or cause and effect. And we're making these massive leaps if we believe this.
You think so?
We can't witness at all. just for the sake of trying to prove something that we want to believe and disprove something we don't want to believe.
Yeah. So just on that point, do you think it's maybe a provable fact that loneliness does increase cortisol and might have some negative health effects over time? Do you think that might be measurable? Ryan's.
Yes.
And Nikki is too. I trust Nikki more than Ryan actually did. So, I don't know. What do you think? Sean, Santi, you guys are kind of medicine or in, you know, what do you think?
I mean, I guess just my perspective on the particular quote, I mean, it's context driven, at least with science in particular, right? Like, of course, just from the scientific method, you can't ever say one thing 100% conclusive, but right, it's a bunch of studies over time and trying to make mean of that studies. Because at the end of the day, people don't want to do science just in a vacuum, just to say, oh, look, we proved something. No, we want to add context to whatever greater meaning of life, whether it be we're doing all these studies to find a cure for disease or trying to improve people's lives. Like in this case, just being around people will make us healthier.
Sure. I mean, make us healthy somehow, right? Yeah.
So, Marty, as I think, pointed out, I mean, at the end, it's a very measurable scientific measurement. But then the rest is just conjecture.
Yeah.
Total conjecture.
I'm guessing that Dr. Murthy was probably not around when those people were staying up all night, taking turns, keeping watch by the fire. And that was Ryan's point, right? I thought there was kind of an interesting statement about the, there was something baked in. Oh, yeah. That need for social connection became baked into our nervous system. That doesn't seem like a very technical description. I don't know. But I don't know. Baking is technical, I guess, in some ways, but talking into our genes. Santi, were you going to say something?
I think the idea in general seems to be a romanticization of the hunter-gatherer society. That seems to happen quite a bit.
I know. It does.
And I don't know how he reached obesity from discussing a hunter-gatherer society and how obese people would have even survived in such societies.
Well, right. We're supposed to go back to that diet, I guess, to be even more healthy, aren't we? To go back to the instead of eating all this red meat and everything. Yeah, I'm not trying to be, you know, making fun of this at all. I'm just saying that really there's an observable chemical kinds of description here that is interesting, and it may even have some relevance in, you know, helping people. And he goes on to talk about that they have programs associated with medical treatment where they actually assess the degree to which people have a sense of community and try to address that, because that seems like it's part of the problem.
Hey, Marty, it's Patrice.
Yeah, Patrice.
The voice of balance to some extent, because I don't like it when atheists throw everything we believe out, and I don't want to throw everything out that other people that scientists believe. And, you know, I think there's reasons and proof that some of these things exist, but it seems to be getting way to the other direction right now, and everybody's looking for an excuse or a reason to say, well, that's why I'm blank.
Yeah, right.
But it seems especially alarming to me right now that so many people I know in their 20s are depressed and have anxiety and have all these things that they seem to be, like, celebrating or, you know, embracing. And you don't want to ignore it, but at the same time, it's almost like society is wanting to say, you know, it's not your fault, there's all these reasons, et cetera, et cetera. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. And because it's science and it's happening to me and I'm part of the machine, I don't have to take personal responsibility, really.
Right.
Let me ask a more general question about this. Do you think it's possible that there might be, as a Christian, an alternate explanation for the human need for company?
Yeah.
And a kind of a social and even physical benefit that comes from fellowship with a community of people? Can you think of a kind of a, like, a Christian explanation for that? That may even make more sense than the business about being by the fire and staying up all night and that kind of thing, right? And baking in something. It's never clear to me how these particular events in our lives end up getting baked into our genetics. I guess Darwin would argue that if you didn't have that gene, that wanted to have somebody keeping watch with you overnight, you would die, and that would, you know, select you out of the gene pool somehow or another. But anyway, I would just say, as Christians, we should look at this and say, you know what? We are amazing creations, and God has put within us a complexity that we can't even fathom, right? And we struggle, and you can tell this guy is kind of, I mean, to me, it's just like, okay, let's make up a story, because we wouldn't want to say that God made us people who really do need the company of others, not only just to survive, but for our own emotional stability. You see how a Christian would look at this in a different way, and yet come to the same conclusion, right, about our need for company and how it's unhealthy for us to be alone and those kinds of things. Do you agree with that? I mean, so we don't have to dispute the finding. The cortisol level can be measured, after all, I suppose, right? But we can have an alternate explanation. All right.
Marty, you can just, we saved a few 100,000 years by observing that when God made man, he saw it was good that he not be alone, and so he made him companion and arranged for children to be born rapidly. Right. So God just made us that way.
Yeah, thank you.
Conclusion's the same.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is, like we did last week, I would like us to examine three questions, and I have put these three questions in the chat room. Can you all find them? Can somebody give me a head, open your chat, and you should find three questions there. You see them? No, of course. Okay, hang on. Let me let Grant in while I'm here. And open the chat. Oh, I sent it to everyone in the waiting room. I don't know what y'all's problem is. That doesn't seem like a bug. That's not a good thing. All right, how about now? You see the chat? Three questions, and here they are. These are the three questions. Think about our worldview: six things, personal, infinite God, who is the original creator. He had personality, communication. Man is spiritual, superior to the animals, but physical and with spiritual awareness. The world is fallen. A propositional revelation from God doesn't tell us everything we wish we knew, but it does say things that are ultimately truer than what we can discover ourselves. Jesus came as God in the flesh, and then the universe is temporary. And that imperfection of its fallenness will be fixed and repaired, even as evil and good will be. So, how does a Christian react to scientific facts? In quotes, these are which contradict the Bible narrative and values, and I gave you an example of that. Number two, the uses of technology to practice and promote evil. Does that ever happen? And then scientific studies. And so these are somewhat general questions. I don't want to give you very long, maybe only 5 minutes. And go through these one, two, and three, and see if any of these kinds of fundamental facts or these foundation principles of our worldview would inform any of your thinking about this. That is, the news reports of scientific facts that contradict the Bible, how technology is used for promoting evil sometimes. Does that mean technology is evil, or what does that mean? And then, should we study science, since most educators in science are non-Christian, okay? So I'm going to do some breakout rooms, and I think we'll do maybe 7 rooms. And here they are being created. And you see the questions are in the chat. Does everybody see the questions? I hope they stay there. All right. No, you still don't see them, Aaron? Can you bring up your chat window down at the bottom? There's a thing called chat, and it will bring up a window. Down at the bottom of the screen, it looks like a conversation bubble. Can other people see it? Kay, can you see the chat questions?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. All right. Well, Aaron, you'll be in a group with somebody who can, I suppose. All right? All right. 5 minutes, and you got to come right back. All right? Ready? 3, 2, 1. I think you have... Oh, I guess so. I guess when I mute everybody, I muted myself too. So I do have everyone on mute, but you can press the space bar and hold it down, and it will unmute you. So if you want to make a comment, real quick, is there anything, just like maybe the primary point, number one, are we going to read articles that kind of seem to violate the Bible narrative and, but they seem to explain things and stuff like that? How to react to that based on these six principles? What comes to mind?
Marty?
Yeah.
What comes to my mind is God is always right, and there's no fluctuation, should be any fluctuation in a Christian's mind. You just accept what God says, and that's it.
Okay. So has he spoken to us on some things? Yes, in the propositional revelation. So as we really, this is a, if you think about it, this lesson is just a more special version of the lesson we had on truth and knowledge. And that is, you start with things you know for certain in whatever you do. And once you've established the inspiration of truth, then you can begin with that. And so that doesn't discount everything that someone says, but it does say that it would take precedent over what we would hear. That's a clear violation. So when I read that article, I'm interested in cortisol and loneliness and all that. That's interesting. But I discount the things that really are pretty clear violations of you know, the of what the Bible narrative is. Let me let people in. Okay. Use of technology to practice and promote evil. Any of these apply to that? Does that mean all technology is bad?
We're living in a fallen world.
There you go. That's it. And really, it's no surprise that anything man invents. In fact, I might have to say that some inventions may even have evil at their purpose, right? If we are living in a fallen world. So that's something to be concerned about. But even things invented for good or with no real, you know, kind of neutral motive, I suppose, morally, could be used for evil. And that shouldn't surprise us. That's really, and we'll see that from the beginning of time, that's been the history of mankind. Now, about the third one, scientific studies. Should we run away from those since some of the scientists, many in fact today, are not really believers? Maybe we shouldn't study these kind of things because they'll lead us away and they'll maybe help, you know. Is that, what do you think about that?
Well, Marty, because the world has fallen, our, at best, our science, our understanding is flawed and imperfect. And at worst, it's biased by evil intentions.
So
someone
maybe
wanting to advance an agenda.
Right, so maybe we should run away. Maybe we should not study those kind of things, not make observations like that.
But even science that is published by non-Christians is loaded with information that points to God. So, I mean, to me, a lot of the science that you see is greater proof of God. And even if it's just for our own benefit to look and to see, you know, that, yeah, the complexities of God's creation. If you look at it from that perspective of, if I look at this, it's going to have to be understanding a little bit more about the amazing things God has done to create me. And when he tells Job about everything that he did, and you see some of the details about that and how they're kept in place, you're just even more amazed by those things.
So look carefully at the second principle, that man is spiritual. Do we have a part of us that is interested in the eternal and maybe in the kind of the wisdom of God? Yes, we do. But we also have a physical side, and they're often in conflict with each other. But I wonder if the animals do like math to describe, you know, falling bodies and those kind of things. Well, they don't. And animals don't kind of reason about cortisol levels in the blood either. So my point is that there is a kind of superiority that God's given man. I think you see that in the second principle, don't you? That we're really put here with an intellect and a free will and ability to... In fact, he told them to, Adam and Eve, to have dominion over the earth. What does that mean? Does it require some level of understanding, investigation, prediction, description? Okay, so again, our introduction has pretty much covered almost all the material, but we'll go through now what the Bible says about these various questions, and I'll go through in a little bit different sequence, but I'll remind you that if you have the lesson material, this is the material here. And I'm just going through these questions, which are on page, whatever page that is, I can't tell. But it's lesson 8 on science and technology, and I'm going through these questions 1 through 8. And I can't have a whole lesson without reminding us of the T-shirt lady. And I just want to remind you that her point of view was that, well, I should ask you, but you notice that she really felt like if you don't accept science, evolution, and all the latest theories, that you're just going to be lost in the past. And you're ignoring the main source of truth. We kind of talked about that in the truth and knowledge lesson. And so she even believes that what we would say is that we would be against science, and the things we believe would be against science. That's kind of her view of what religious people generally, especially fundamentalists, would believe, is that science is just to be rejected just on the basis that it's science. And we struggle, you know, to actually come around to the fact that the earth is round. And certainly we would accept evolution as just a theory and so on. So that's kind of a popular position, I think, about how these things work. So let's go through the lesson. I'll define science as the systematic knowledge of the physical or material world that we gain by observation and experimentation. And I think everybody does this every day. Don't you? I mean, I've fooled around in the kitchen a lot more in the last few years, and I've learned lots of things. If you do something, then it blows up or it flattens or it does something, you know, and if I don't keep track of that, I'm just going to make the same mistake over and over. And it seems like there's some value in trying to figure out, well, why does it do that? Right? I've noticed that bowls that are kind of shaped with wide mouths, I can boil grits in the microwave and it doesn't even overflow. But you put a bowl that has a steep edge on it and it'll pour all over the place. I don't know why that is, but I observe that, right? And I even know which bowls work better than others, right? And so I have begun to observe the material world. Is there any morality in what I've just described? Good or bad? No. But I wonder if a dog does that as much and thinks about it the way. Maybe there's some conditioning that occurs, but I doubt if there's any math behind it and so on. Anyway, and then we'll define technology as that branch of knowledge that deals with how the creation and use of technical means and their interrelation with life, society, the environment, drawing on such subjects as industrial arts, engineering, applied science, and pure science. So we're going to make science be just learning about stuff and technology be where you learn. It will be where you take that and you invent things. And so, you know, I invent a bowl that's wide at the mouth and I can boil my grits in it and it doesn't mess up the microwave. You see, that's a useful thing that makes my life better. Anyway, that's going to be our definitions. Are either of those inherently evil or good, really? No, they're not. But you can see already the opportunity that you could take something that you're going to be making useful and you could use it either way for good or for bad. So here are the questions and with Bible verses that describe the answer. First, I think we would start, as always, with an infinite personal God who created the universe. And I'll go even further to say that he, or through his son, sustains the physical universe. Here are a few verses. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which were seen were not made of the things which are visible. If you look harder at that whole chapter, really, the theme of it is that the things that are not seen, which are supernatural, the nature of God and so on, are superior to the things that are seen. I think we forget that. We emphasize the physical and what we think of as hard, cold facts over some spiritual realm, but the Hebrew writer is trying to say, no, it's the other way around. Think about it. Which had to come first, an uncaused cause or the cause itself? And he argues that really the unseen created the seen, so it's therefore greater. Hebrews 1 goes on to say that it's through God's Son that he made the worlds, and not only that, but also he upholds all things by the word of his power. And then similarly in Colossians 1:17, Jesus, preeminent, is before all things and in him all things consist. So we look at the created world, never forget that God's holding it in his hand. Whatever's there, the science, the equations that are behind it, the laws that are permanent from day to day, those are because of the infinite creator. And that's the Christian's view of things. And so when I look at the world and I see a consistent order, or I see the beauty of the mathematics, if you like to look at it that way, I should be thinking to myself, well, that's no big surprise, because God's making it and upholding it by his wisdom. And we ought to expect that, actually. Okay, so there's a point I want to make. I'm not sure exactly when to make it, but I'll get to it. So God apparently, according to the Proverbs, used a set of principles, and it's almost described in Proverbs 8, which I'll bring that up. If you read the verses before this, before verse 27, it says before, the word before occurs over and over. Before there was a sea, before the earth was formed and all that, I was there. Again, wisdom personified. As if these principles existed before there was nature, before there was anything there. And then when, now you notice the word when is dominant here from verse 27 forward. So at the act of creation, these principles which were pre-existent were put into effect in the natural world. And as if this craftsman, I guess she is personified as a woman for much of Proverbs. But anyway, I was beside him as a master craftsman. That is, seems like the almost like an advisor, an architect, the principle in which the world was created. When he prepared the heavens, when he drew the circle, when he established the clouds, when he strengthened the fountains, when he put the limits to the sea, and so on. And so there was this principle that pre-existed and then was applied or put into effect at the creation. Not only that, there's kind of a mirror piece of that, and that is man was created then as the crowning achievement in God's image. And guess what? He was given ears and eyes, we might say the other senses, to be able to perceive what's in the world. So God made these senses along the same wisdom principles as he did the laws of nature that are in the world. And so I should expect that for man in particular, there would be a compatibility between my ability to observe and the physical laws themselves. And it'd be something that would be special for man. We'll talk about that in just a second. And now here's I don't think this is controversial, but I think it's perceived that Christians don't generally believe this. And that is, we really are intended to investigate and control the world while not neglecting our spiritual nature. Does that surprise anybody that would actually admit it on the video here? Probably not. Probably both of those conditions don't get met. But I think that God put us here and gave us a superiority to the animals and just a slight inferiority to the angels who watched all this happening. I don't know. But he says in Psalm 8, he gave dominion to man over the works of your hand and put all things under his feet. To me, that seems like God has put within us a superior ability to actually control things. And how do you control them if you don't understand them? And how do you understand them if you don't describe them and observe them? So it seems to me that was in place even before the fall, probably more effective before the fall, if you think about it. And that matches, of course, the Genesis account in which God told Adam and Eve before the fall to fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over it. I think the implication is that man, Adam and Eve, and their family, even in an unfallen world, would have had a lot of study to do. And a beautiful study in a world that wasn't fallen, and probably they would be able to discover and invent and do a lot of things. But I'm speculating a little bit here, but still I think that's part of what God intended man to do and gave him an intellect to do that and gave him eyes and ears compatible with the world around him. Jesus makes a reference to that ability to see a cloud. We reference this in another lesson, I think the one on knowledge and truth, actually. You see a cloud. You know, it's coming off the sea, Mediterranean Sea, and sure enough, there's a cloud, there's a shower coming. Or you see the wind coming up from the desert, and that's what happens. And, of course, he goes on to say that the spiritual principles are of the same nature. If you can observe these principles, you can see them in the spiritual realm as well. This is interesting to me, Proverbs 6:6. You know this proverb probably very well. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Now, think about that for a minute. I wonder if an ant ever looks at humans and says, what can I learn from humans? You know, I doubt that that's true, but who knows what's in the ant brain? I don't know. But there's something complex about that. about looking at ants. You've ever done that? They're pretty fascinating. I'm sure everybody has, especially as a kid. I see some of my grandkids, they just get fascinated with ants. Of course, they just want to know if they're going to hurt you or not. But they kind of seem to have a purpose, and they go here and there, and they seem to even talk to each other, and they're carrying things almost as big as they are and storing them up and building these nests. And of course, the writer of Proverbs expands a lot on, you know, how clever they really are. They don't even seem to have a leader or any kind of giving grace. Now, is there something we can learn from that? That seems like quite a leap to make an analogy between an ant carrying stuff and putting it in a nest and something that a human would do. But we can, can't we? About preparation and work and the power of group activity and other things. And individual initiative. I mean, I learned lots of things. It's interesting that I have that kind of thinking in my head that lets me go to the ant and become wiser from just observing that. And if it's true for the ant, I wonder if there is not other things in nature that we can become wise by just seeing how they work and learning about the principles of nature. I've made too much of that point. I think y'all know it. But here's what Darwin said about the ability of man to come to conclusions, whether moral or otherwise, it seems to me. And I think this quote almost falls in on himself to say, why should I believe what you've come up with, Mr. Darwin? But he said this, he read in a letter to a friend, he said, but then with me is the horrid doubt always, it always arises, whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. I think I agree with that. There ought to be that kind of doubt. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind if there are any convictions in such a mind? And that's a good question, if we see any evidence of that. You see what he's saying? And it just seems to me I might fold that back in on the theory of evolution and say, well, why should I trust that kind of speculation since it was the product of a monkey's mind or something like that? Anyway, interesting idea, but I think the Christian has a little different view of things that says, no, God made my mind to be like his. And he also made the world with laws and things that I can observe that are compatible. And he expected me to observe them and learn from them. And I trust what I learn way more than I would if I just thought I was just evolved from a simple-minded animal. Anyway, I just throw that in. I will say this. This is the point I want to make earlier, but it probably has to be said. If you read the Schaefer book, you probably got this point too. What he calls modern science began, after the so-called Dark Ages, and when man started to notice that nature had a beauty about it and an order about it, but he had not lost his conviction that he himself was created in the image of God. And so there was a great confidence that you could see the beauty and order of God's mind in nature. And so we ought to look into it. So a guy like Newton wrote as many words about theology, not that we would agree with all of it, as he did about science. And so a lot of the early, what Schaefer calls modern scientists, of course, they're not modern anymore because it's been 400 or 500 years ago. A lot of the modern scientists began their investigation out of a deep faith in God and the confidence that they'd find something sensible if they started to try to write equations or something. Now, what Schaefer calls modern science is kind of interesting. And that's the scientists that have long ago forgotten why scientists at all started looking for stuff. And they're just kind of coasting along with no real sense of meaning. And we'll come to that at the end of the lesson about how that really affects the way we view the world. And maybe even the way we do science. I don't know. But anyway, I would say modern science, to which we owe a great deal of the comforts of our lives each day, began, I think, ultimately, with men who had a deep faith in God. If you go look up a biography of Faraday, you've probably heard of Faraday, who learned a lot about electricity and electric fields and all. He was a deeply religious guy, and a lot of the scientists, when they found things, they saw it, as I think Ryan mentioned, as evidence of a spiritual mind. And a wisdom of God behind it. Okay, so I think we're intended to investigate and control the world, but not neglecting our spiritual, maybe building on that. I think God approves, and I think he even has in the past, at least, assisted in our investigation of nature. I think if God rules in the natures, in the nations of men, he might rule in the scientists of men. I don't know. And determine when and what's discovered at various points in time. I don't know. And I don't mean it's all good. We're in a fallen world, but it may be that in his providence, just like he uses evil nations, he may use technology in bad ways or allow man to do that to bring about a larger plan of his. But look, take a look at these. You remember Daniel was selected among those Hebrew, I guess, royalty in a way. And the Babylonians were looking for young men without any physical defect, but they showed an aptitude for every kind of learning. Well-informed, quick to understand. So already at home in Judah, Daniel was learning those kinds of things. He was quick to understand, and then he was taken to Babylon and educated. And if you look down at verse 20 of Daniel chapter 1, which I didn't put in here, it says that they learned all the stuff from the Babylonians, and their knowledge exceeded the astrologers and sorcerers of Babylon, right? And that was, I guess, proof that the bread and water was good for their minds or something. But you know, the point is the scientists of their day, which I guess you think of as the astrologer, they learned way more than they did. And you have to think that was God's providence allowing them to do that. And then Solomon, you remember wisdom that came from God. He prayed for that. But he didn't just learn about how to cut babies in half, you know, and other things like that. He actually learned about trees and the cedars of Lebanon, the little hyssop that comes out of the wall, and animals and birds and creeping things and fish. And that sounds like biology to me. It sounds like a kind of science. And it was something that Solomon was interested in addition to all the other things which we can read about in, say, Ecclesiastes and maybe the Proverbs as well. But that was included in the wisdom God gave to him. So I think it's reasonable to think that God does approve. And I think that he even used the skills and knowledge that some men had and he enhanced in his own service. You remember in the building of the tabernacle, there were gifted craftsmen. I'm assuming they learned to do work in metal and build things that were strong and design fabrics and weave them in various ways and carve stuff. Anyway, there are some who are gifted, and then there's a couple of guys listed in Exodus chapter 36 who were put to the work of the tabernacle. So the artwork and the construction techniques and all of that for the tabernacle, and I would have to assume for the temple as well, were blessed by God as they were being used in his service. I'll also mention Isaiah 44, and I don't have time to read it, but it's the text you probably remember that describes all the things these men could do with wood, but they also make an idol out of it. But in that text, if you look at it, he talks about all these arts and crafts, metalwork and carpentry, cutting, marking. He talks with an ark and stuff, growing trees, planting pine trees is what my version says, and harvesting them, including big cedars. Doing woodworking, including artful carving that makes it look like it's in the form of a person. Heating a home to stay warm, cooking. And so using these various technologies for various purposes. And I put three dots because we're going to come back to that passage in a minute, as you might guess. There are other things, uses to which they could be put. But you see, these are useful things, aren't they? Metalwork and carpentry and carving and heating and cooking. Various things that the bounty that God had provided in the trees and other things, metals, could be used for. However, man can, and often does, use that same technology for evil. And so there are a lot of examples. You can almost look from the beginning of time in Cain's descendants, all of a sudden cities. I don't know if God approves of cities or not. It just seemed like they're sources of evil. I know there's the heavenly city, but when you get inside it, you know what it actually is? It's a garden. So I don't know. But the city of Babylon, of course, which we're going to get to in a second, became kind of the archetypical picture of evil. But anyway, Cain's descendants, which doesn't, to me, provide much recommendation for building cities, but it's a place where people gather. I suppose they make money faster there because of commerce. There's more division of labor. Obviously, an interdependency. They started, you know, building tents, interesting idea, a temporary shelter that could be mobile, and owning livestock. I assume that means instead of just kind of getting animals from nature, hunter-gatherers, we talked about those guys earlier, right? They actually could herd them and keep them and own them. I suppose ownership is part of that. They invented music and invented metallurgy and some other things in Cain's descendants. And then it doesn't take too long to get to the Tower of Babel, which was an interesting marvel of technology, but built for pride. That never happens today, I don't suppose. And by the time we get to the period of the Judges and on into the reign of Saul, of course, the Philistines and others, the Canaanites, by their use of technology of chariots and weapons and sharpening instruments and so on, were able to oppress the Israelites. Now, part of that was God's judgment, but still you can see a use of technology to dominate another set of people. Not a good moral thing to do. Amos describes technology for evil pleasures, inventing musical instruments like David, drinking wine from bowls, and I'm assuming the ointments and the wine and all of those were higher and higher quality developed to create more and more pleasure. And God condemns them for that, for their idleness and for their, I guess, to some extent, debauchery or wastefulness somehow. Anyway, and then back to Isaiah 44. I said we'd come back to this, and that's in verse 17. After doing all those things with that wood, cooking food, heating his home, and the rest of it, he makes into a god, his carved image. He falls down before it, and he worships it. And he goes on to say some of the things that is actually done with regard to that worship. So clearly the same inventions, the same kinds of technology or applied science can be used for good or evil purposes. And so that raises, and not a surprise, of course, in a fallen world. Here's another real important point, and I think that the T-shirt lady would probably not agree with this, but there are problems, deep problems, that technology will not solve, that all of man's wisdom together will not fix. And I think there's a confidence in science that grows out of the fact that it has made such rapid progress. Interrupt me, by the way, if you have a point to make or if I'm not being clear, but do you see that all the science that has accelerated in the last few, do you think that gives us a sense of false confidence that we're going to get there quickly? That, you know, and who is it? One of the lessons, somebody said this guy was coming up with some way that we ought to be able to live for 500 years, with just, if we could get the right chemistry and all. Wasn't that in one of our lessons not too long ago? We're having so many, I get them all mixed up. Anyway, as if anybody would want to live 500 years. But anyway, there is a false confidence in science, but I think there's some things that we're just not going to solve. And there's several reasons. One is, I only live right now. I'm not in yesterday anymore, and I don't have any idea what's going to happen tomorrow. I really only live in today, and I'm not even all that clear about what's supposed to happen today or what will happen today. So I'm limited in time, and I don't know what will happen tomorrow. And really, in the end, there's so much that looks like random chance to me. A lot of things that just, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how the coin will fall on the ground, but God does, but I don't. It seems a lot of it seems unpredictable to me, and that's of course the point of that proverb. Not to mention that I'm limited in space. I'm limited in time, we mentioned earlier, but I'm limited in space. I didn't go up to heaven. I didn't go down to underneath the sea. I don't have the power to see things. There's a kind of an interesting, almost like a little parable of sorts about the man who wanted to describe the fish in the sea. And so he got a net. And he put the net into the sea, and he gathered up all the fish. And the net had holes in it that were about that big. And he decided that all the fish in the sea were bigger than that. Why did he decide that? Well, because he had to measure. So he said, well, that's not good. So he made another net that had smaller holes in it, and he caught. But then when he thought about it, what kind of net would he need to describe all the fish in the sea? And all the life in the sea. He'd have to catch the whole ocean, right? with a net that had no holes at all. And you see, that's kind of the point in science. You'll always make, and if you've ever done experiment or done a lab in high school or college, there's always some assumption you're going to make, which is almost foolish, right? We're just going to ignore friction in this experiment. As if somehow another friction goes away. I see some people are laughing more than others on that, but right. I mean, I taught physics. I don't know, probably 2/3 of the labs we ignored friction, and we ignored heat transfer, you know, out of the beaker, and we had a bunch of other things. Anyway, that's because we just cannot gather the whole ocean in our hands, and we cannot hold all the wind and the earth in our, we can't observe everything at once, and so we have to make approximations. Is that clear? I hope everybody sees that, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means it's approximate and it's uncertain, and there will always be limits to what we can understand. Anybody want to agree or disagree to that? I think you all can see that. And the more you've studied, you know, science, as it's called, you, the more you'll see that. And then more important is we're not going to solve the problems of poverty and suffering and death and evil in the world, or any of the spiritual issues. That's really not the topic of science, and we don't really have the tools of investigation to know that. We depend on propositional revelation to understand about evil in the world and spiritual issues. But here's something Jesus said, "For the poor you have with you always." That's a little out of context, but I think he was saying, you know what, there's going to be always opportunity for you to take care of the poor, right? And I think that implies that there probably will always be economic inequity in the world. That's just the fallen nature of the world. Proverbs 27:20 says destruction or hell and Sheol, I think other translations, are never full. So are the eyes of men never satisfied. People are not going to stop dying. I hope that doesn't surprise or disappoint anybody, but that we're just not going to conquer death. And I take that to be a propositional statement from God. It's appointed to man once to die. And I don't know, maybe somebody will come up with a theory that can find the gene that does aging and turn it off, but I just don't believe that will happen because I think God has said it won't. Proverbs 27:20, there are some things that never seem satisfied. They seem imperfect, and the grave is one of them. But interesting, the barren womb, and I take that to mean man's aspirations, or in this case woman's, but still more generally, things we desire deeply. They're ingrained in our emotions to want, to expect, to feel that if we don't get them somehow it's unjust or unfair, but they're not going to be filled up. And I think maybe loneliness falls in that category. I don't know, but I think there are many things in life that just seem like they ought to be fixed, but they're not. And then the earth, and I don't know if this is an environmental statement or not, but the Proverbs writer seems to suggest that there's always going to be a shortage of something, maybe water. And I wonder if God had an idea where man might go with this technology and what he might do to the earth. And I wonder if he might have even made the world resilient enough to handle that, or at least to carry out a plan as he had in mind. I suspect he did. And fire as well. So these are unsolvable problems. I think they'll always be with us. And of course, the fear of death, which goes along with the presence of death, and then, of course, this continuing conflict of evil in my life. These are examples. There's chats happening, and I'm missing the chats. Yeah, so Danny, it's all Danny. Danny, I think you're talking to yourself. I don't know. I'm just kidding. But anyway, thanks. That's what the blinking is. All right, let me go back to this. So, there is permanent evil in the world. This text is, well, the whole chapter of Proverbs 30 is almost like saying it all makes sense pretty much till you get to chapter 30. And then the Proverbs writer, Solomon, maybe put this in there, although it's attributed to other men in that text. But to say, well, it's not all that clear cut. It's not that easy. Things don't always go like you think they would. And part of that in Proverbs 30 is just to say there's just a bunch of evil in the world. A generation, and that's an interesting Hebrew word. It means like a cycle or an era of time that curses its father, doesn't bless its mother, pure in its own eyes, even though it's filthy. devours the poor, and so on. So those are things that we might make some progress, but they will never be solved with technology and science. All right. And then the last point is that there is a danger as we do this investigation and maybe even exploit what we learn in science, that it will make us proud. And we might even become preoccupied with the physical and neglect the spiritual. Somebody went off mute. I would love for you to talk, if you would. Nope.
Marty, something hit me last week, or I was reading something, that last week, 100 years ago, scientists were deciding if the universe was bigger than the Milky Way, our galaxy. That the general consensus of science was that the universe was our galaxy. And then about 3 years later, yeah. Hubble
yeah.
said no.
Right.
That Andromeda, that you think the stars? No, it's a galaxy.
Yeah.
And then I just...
And not only that, they're all running away from us. And the farther they are, the faster they're moving away with the redshift and so on.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that that revolution, really, in the sense of it was very radical. It was a huge change. It was hard for the astronomers to deal with. And even guys like Einstein, just they had to go look through the telescope, their own eyes, and still didn't want to believe it. Just because it seemed unfathomable that the universe was just permanently expanding. How could that be?
And hundreds and hundreds of galaxies.
Yes, way far, I was about to say, in the scale that we can't really even comprehend.
Yeah. I still have a hard time, and I'm so humbled when I see these pictures of one galaxy colliding into another galaxy.
Yeah. So.
Very humbling.
As long as we're telling stories. So in 1975 or 6, I was working on my master's thesis in particle physics, and the idea of quarks had just been invented. And what was interesting about that is you could go back to my dad's textbooks, and it would say that, I think it said that protons and neutrons, it may not even have said, Sewell, you can help me here, but the thought was in the early part of the 1900s that an atom was as small as anything could be. And then it was protons and electrons and neutrons, and that was as small as anything could be. Well, no, they just keep, there gets to be smaller and smaller things. So as Danny's described, as our ability to observe the universe in the large scale has increased, it's just receded before us, right? And as our ability to look smaller and smaller and model at the smaller scale, it's shrunken before us. So that our ability to really understand and describe in some absolute sense, and that the whole idea of just holding the wind in your hands or holding the ocean, that seems to be the same kind of a metaphor, really. Or catching all the fish in the sea with a net in that has no holes in it and catches the whole sea. That's we're just not going to get that. And I think, I believe maybe God even designed the world and at the smallest level and the largest level, the cosmos, to keep whacking us in the face and say, hey, you ain't that big. You don't know that much. And the more we think we know, the more the vastness and the complexity recedes before us.
Marty, I believe that any pursuit of knowledge is justified if we begin with the fear of the Lord.
Yes,
it's the beginning of knowledge. It's the beginning of wisdom. And that's God's purpose.
And beginning with that stays with us. And point 9, I was going to say that near the dangers is that we discover something and we invent something. And I keep thinking of Cain's lineage or the Tower of Babel people, and we get filled with pride because we've accomplished something, as if it was had any sense of scale compared to the universe. Of course, that's one danger, and the other is that we just get preoccupied with the physical. Let me just show you a few Bible verses related to that. You remember Nebuchadnezzar built the Great Babylon, and when he walked around, and of course you remember what happened to him because of his little outburst of pride here. He said, is this not great Babylon that I have built for royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? And you can see, and it was pretty clear what happened as a result of that. And again, Jesus saying the same thing. We get all, we're so good at the weather prediction, but somehow or another, we're just not able to see the obvious signs of our spiritual nature and our conscience. And then, of course, the evidence of the resurrection and other things in history that make us believe that God came in the flesh. Somehow, and that's what Jesus was talking about here. He said, you're looking right at some things that you ought to be able to determine pretty easily that I'm speaking from God. You can predict the weather, which is harder, it seems to me, than maybe the obvious conclusion that they could have drawn then. So I want to end, unless there's more discussion, but I want to end by talking about this diagram. You remember this diagram? And it shows that God and man share a nature, a spiritual nature. And I believe that's what it means that man was created in the image of God, though I don't fully understand all of what that means. I think it means that God and man can communicate, that he can speak in words of propositional revelation, that I can know many things from God that I wouldn't know from just observing the natural world through science and other things. And I also have an accountability to God. I share his nature and emotions, things with love and loyalty and communication and other things. And so that you understand that thing. And so in that picture, and then also, but I live in a natural world, which is finite. It doesn't have a spiritual side. And what we're talking about really in this lesson is the investigation of that natural world. Of course, as modern scientists, we understand that the worlds were made by God, Hebrews 11, as we talked about. And so I feel like that's a good thing. It's another way of learning. I learned from other people. I learned from observing the world. Of course, the propositional revelation should be the beginning of wisdom, as we talked about. And so I've been given the gift, maybe even the responsibility by God, to have dominion, subdue, understand the world. And I would call that science, whatever level it operates. But at the same time, what governs my look at that is what God has revealed to me about who I am, about why I'm here, about what rules I should live by as I invent things or apply the science and technology. And a hope that for the things I don't understand and for the things that I can't fix, there's a solution. It's outside of myself, but God will fix it. And that's our sixth principle, our final principle about a temporary universe and a judgment and a remedy for all of that. But here's the problem, and this is what Schaefer addresses. If you take God out of the picture, on what basis then do I govern the use of technology? Or on what basis do I have a confidence that I really am intended to learn from that or to solve what problems I can? Or that the flaws and the unsolvable problems really will be made right one day? Or really, what confidence do I have that I'm really any different from the natural world? And that Darwin quote comes to mind, right? Why do I think I'm getting it right, since I'm just part of that natural world and really no better and in no way superior to it?
Yeah.
You see that? Do you see the difficulty there?
Yes.
And so thanks, James.
Hey, can I, while you're there, can I say one thing?
Please.
So thinking about the T-shirt lady, if you listen to some of the words she was using to describe things she thought were harmful or hurtful or bad, the problem she has, again, we're talking about you remove God. Those words that she's using, they mean nothing. It's just kind of a giant opinion. She's trying to say, she's making statements as if there's a source that says something is evil or something is bad or you
right.
shouldn't do that.
Well, I even say more abstractly, she says, how do you think you'll ever improve society? By what measure?
Yeah.
Do you determine that one society is better than another? That some of the smart people live longer and the dumb people die sooner? That'd be one, right?
Yeah.
Or what? I mean, make up your own definition. Yes, I think James's point is that we really, as humans, I mean, that God made us this way, we can't escape the value-laden language and really emotional reactions to things. We just can't. And I hope next week, if we get done with the art and culture thing, we'll maybe come back and talk about how some of the points we might make from this the lady's language, and so we wouldn't want a week to go by without bashing her to some extent. But I think she, in many ways, helps us understand first of the culture that we're in, but also how really we're all kind of still in the image of God, no matter whether we admit it or not. Anyway, thanks for that, James. So anyway, without God, I don't really know how I'm supposed to use this technology, and I might do harmful things with it. And I might justify it by improving society or some other thing, because I don't really know for sure why I'm any more valuable than these lower animals from which I evolved, to quote Darwin. And so here's what Schaefer says happens. And I don't know if you got this from the book or not, but I think this is what he's trying to say, is that man can't hardly stand it not having a value up here, just as James says. We still talk about improving society, right? And we still get mad at people who abuse us, right, or abuse other people, or take away my rights, or claim I don't have freedom, or whatever they do. I don't like that. So in its place, to try to provide meaning and purpose and some rules to live by and maybe even some hope that the world will get better somehow, I think science and philosophy often fills that void. So we have this great optimism that science and technology is going to fix things, right? It's going to solve disease and eliminate death and make us stop feeling guilty and other things like that. And given that we're not maybe people who are all that logical, we might go the other direction. So instead of hard, cold measurements and test tubes, we just say, well, no, the rational side just never going to get there. It doesn't give me any meaning at all. It's just part of the naturalistic, deterministic world. So I'm just going to escape into my emotions. And I know it's so because I feel it. And anyway, the less logical it is, the more easily defended it is, because nobody can argue against it, right? And it's subjective and I feel it. And so nature, maybe it becomes some, I can look at the ant and maybe that's a source of value I can live with, or understand that all of nature is going to some path. So therefore we should protect it, I guess. I don't know. And then I think just maybe emotional reactions, which I'm not sure is much different from mysticism, and including, of course, in Schaefer's book, he mentions how that's how the drug culture fits in, because in many of the higher philosophers and so on, that was their way of finding meaning. I even sense some of that now. I mean, I'll hear people say, yeah, we need to go talk about that over a beer. You ever heard that? I think part of that's to be a social what's the word I'm trying to think of? Lubricant, right? Where you get over your inhibitions. But I think there's some sense in which you get more creative, I guess. Or, you know, you have wilder ideas or something, and that's a way you discover more. I think sometimes people talk about drugs as if that's kind of a path to finding more, insights that your logical brain is not going to let you get to. It's just sad that that's where they're. But here's the point of this chart. A bigger danger for science is that it replaces God in this picture. That's the point I'm trying to make. And I think people grasp to that in their hope for something bigger than themselves. It gives us meaning and gives us some purpose and maybe sets some rules. And it doesn't work, of course, but we're tempted to try to do that because we're not comfortable with nothing above this line of outside the natural world. Anyway, so that's it. So I'm going to do a summary right quick. Here it is. God constructed the world using orderly principles that we can understand and discover. I think he approves of that investigation. And it's a kind of wisdom. He calls it that in the Old Testament. And it should increase our faith in God, as we've mentioned a couple of times, just to see through these laws and their beauty back to the wisdom of God, and also to understand how little we know, and therefore how complex and brilliant the mind of God would be. But there are limits to our ability to know, and this knowledge that we have will always be imperfect and changing. Danny said 100 years ago, here's what they thought. Here's a question. You reckon 100 years from today, they might look back and say, you know what, in 2020, they thought that, and then fill in the blank, right? I often think about that, and I think about Mary's chemo, and I'm thinking, I hope in 100 years they will say, they did what to people that had cancer? You know what I mean? And I hope that we made a lot more progress. But somehow we think we're right at the top of the mountain. But all we have to do is look behind us and see how steep the and just assume that that's ahead of us too in terms of discovery and so on. So I think we ought to contain our credulity about scientific discoveries, especially if they violate what our faith tells us. And not that we have answers, by the way. I don't know that we can compete on the scientific level, but there is a huge confidence that what we think today will be what we used to think in 100 years. And so I think that ought to give us some kind of a sense of comfort. So our faith doesn't waver. And again, science and technology have not eliminated the things that are the really hard things. They've put some Band-Aids on them, maybe postponed some things, made them not hurt as much. But if you have loved ones you've lost, you know the big problem's not solved and really won't be until the end of time. And finally, it isn't quite finally, but if applied science can be put to good or bad uses, as it with anything in a fallen world, and it will be judged by the principles of God's word and finally judged at the end of time and made right, as our sixth principle said. And finally, last of all, really, we can't have science replacing divine wisdom, even though we long for something in that upper story, as Schaefer calls it. That's not our source of meaning. It's not the solutions to our problems, the real problems that we have.